This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name is Alex Perney, and today on our interview, we're pleased to welcome on BeQuest Funds, who are going to be discussing the intricacies of investing into non-performing notes and what exactly that looks like and how the possibilities of investing in something that is underperforming can actually be a great performing asset for you. So stick around for that. But today on the download, interesting news from Pfizer. We've pretty much seen a steady about 45-degree increase in price per share of almost any pharmaceutical company that is in any way related to the prophylactics for COVID-19. But Pfizer actually missed their revenue projections due to missed demand for the Paxlovid COVID-19 pills, and shares have dropped almost 15% this month to start off the year. So that is quite the precipitous drop for Pfizer. We'll remain to be seen what type of increase in demand we see for drugs related to COVID-19 as the virus continues to be better controlled with things like vaccine and, again, preventative measures and other prophylactics that are being produced by the pharmaceutical industry. A little bit of sad news, though, at least personally, a big fan of engineering and other big milestones of American ingenuity, Boeing has slated to finish production of its final 747 after 54 years of production, marking an end to an era of aviation design that will sadden aviation geeks around the world. It's very sad to see this. It's over 54 years of production of this iconic jetliner, with the last one rolling off the line and being taken delivery by a transport company, Atlas Worldwide, on February 1st. So the day that this is going out is the last time anyone will roll out of the Everett production facility in Everett, Washington. Good news from the point of inflation being better brought under control. Labor statistics coming out of the last year in Q4 indicate a leveling of labor cost and further cooling of rampant inflation in the U.S. Employment cost index fell a total of 1% in the year last year, which is great news. And this further comes on the heels of Jerome Powell indicating that he expects the rate hikes that have been coming pretty much like clockwork since the beginning of 2022 to end or curtail at least a lot in May of this year. So definitely something to watch out for there. Money hopefully starting to get back on a normal footing with regard to the speed and the velocity of money and the availability of money for things like purchasing homes and other types of business financing. So good news coming out of that with a hopefully stabilizing of inflation in the United States. And finally, some interesting news that I caught. The largest precious metal merger or acquisition, anything in that space is actually happening this year with precious metals acquisitions with the precious metal pandemic kind of halt on acquisitions and mergers. We're seeing Yamana and Pan American Silver agreeing to a cash and stock buyout, which will make one of the largest precious metal producers in the world out of the Canadian manufacturing giant Yamana. So again, definitely something interesting to watch, keep your eye out on, that mergers and acquisitions are starting to happen again with a higher degree of frequency. So if you're into that kind of industry, at least from some industries that have seen a curtailing of those types of activities, definitely something to start watching now is, again, money's becoming more available, industries are getting back on a more solid footing, and we should expect to see more mergers and acquisitions in the coming months and years. This has been The Download. Today on the What is Naked Short Selling? No, this is not a common term used to describe a crazy Friday night at some type of fraternity or a college party. It's actually a kind of an interesting way of performing certain type of security transactions. Naked short selling is actually an illegal practice of short selling shares that have not been affirmatively determined to exist. Ordinarily, traders must borrow a stock or determine that it can be borrowed before they sell it short. So naked short sellers refer to short pressure on a stock that may be larger than the tradable shares in the market. Despite being made illegal after the 2008-09 financial crisis, naked shorting continues to happen because of loopholes in rules and discrepancies between paper and electronic trading systems. Naked shorting takes place when investors sell short associated with shares that they do not possess and do not have confirmed their ability to possess. If the trade associated with the short needs to take place in order to fulfill the obligation of its position, then the trade may fail to complete within the required clearing time because the seller does not actually have access to the shares. The technique has a very high risk level, but the potential to yield high rewards. This has been Naked Short Selling on The What Is. Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name is Alex Perney, and today I'm pleased to welcome on today Martin Sines with BeQuest Funds. We're going to be digging into the nature of investing into non-performing notes. Most of the time when people think about investing in different investment vehicles, we always think about, hey, you know, what's going to be the most viable option? What is performing the best? And there's a lot of meat on the bone to be had when it comes to investing in things that are underperforming, where you can either turn them around or make some type of profit. If you can buy something for pennies on the dollar and, you know, do something good with it, there's always a an avenue to be to be had when it comes to making money. So we're going to dig into that. I'm really excited to talk more about that. So Martin, again, thanks for being on with us, and maybe give us a little bit of background about yourself, about how you, you know, in your career came to be involved in this, and some stuff about BeQuest Funds, and then we'll dig right into it.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Alex. much appreciated. So I think the journey for my wife and I in entrepreneurship started in 04. And when I got out of corporate America, and we really decided that, you know, this was something we're not going to do again. And that's, you know, work a job, and we wanted to be kind of independent and work towards financial freedom. So just to kind of give you this 2 second overview. You know, we launched a federal government contracting company, and we didn't find financial freedom in small business ownership at the time. And we started buying commercial real estate in 2009 and as landlords. And, you know, we thought that we were going to find it with landlording, and we found, you know, a great annuity play. We bought some terrific assets after the 08 crisis, but we didn't find true passive income. That's income that, you know, is just coming to you without any stress and anxiety. And then fast forward a few years, sold the government contracting company in 13, and I started buying mortgage loans that were distressed. And I ran across someone at a local real estate club, and they introduced me to the whole business model. And what I found is really there's two ways you can go when you buy a distressed mortgage note. And let me just first say what a distressed mortgage note is, so that might be helpful. For one, you have banks that originate mortgages, and a portion of those mortgages, about 4%, go into default at some period in time. And so usually it's for due to a job loss or a divorce or a health issue. And so a bank may hold on to that those mortgages for some time, charge it off their books, do whatever they do. And then they pool it together with other distressed mortgages, and they sell it to the secondary mortgage market at a deep discount. Now, the discount used to be much deeper, you know, 10 years ago than it is today, for obvious reasons. But the point is, buy it at a discount. And as an operator, as a hedge fund, you have two choices to make. And first choice is you can exit through the property. So that means filing foreclosure, which displaces the family, take back the property, create a turnkey rental, or get a deed in lieu, something to that effect. You're obtaining the property, you're exiting through the property. The model that I selected for, and we still very much live by, is the mission of keeping homeowners in their homes with payment plans they can afford while making a profit for our company. So we do everything imaginable to create a payment plan to help keep the homeowner in their home. And so for one, it's a good thing to do. It's a good thing to do to keep a family, you know, not having to uproot a family. But number two, You can create a loan modification or other creative solutions that will provide 20 to 30 year cash flow streams back to the investor if done correctly. And sure. so that's what's been our business model for the past 10 years.
So what type of, you know, when it comes to, let's kind of start from the beginning of that. Now, when it comes to buying a mortgage, let's say, you know, I wanted to take some of my capital and just, you know, go buy some mortgages on the secondary market. What does pricing look like for a performing mortgage? Is there kind of like a general spread? Is it normally dollar for outstanding principal? Is it some type of ratio of, you know, whatever the interest rate to the underlying principal and the term of the loan still outstanding? So what does it look like from that? And then we'll get into what it looks like the pricing on, you know, what type of discounts people see when it comes to buying these distressed mortgages. So what's a good looking mortgage on the secondary market mm-hmm. get bought for?
Yeah. So, you know, like anything else in real estate, you know, there's such a wide range in terms of pricing. So if you think of like real estate where you're going to buy in maybe like a hard hit area of Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, you know, a price for that row house is going to be different than, you know, price for, you know, something in Georgetown, DC. And so, you know, maybe same square footage, maybe same proximity to downtown and so forth. But so the quality of the paper determines the pricing. Now, in terms of the range, you know, if you're buying a senior mortgage that's non-performing, then you could be looking at 60 cents all the way up to 90 cents on the dollar, depending on, you know, the collateral that's backing that asset, that mortgage, as well as the homeowner in their situation. On the junior lien side, you know, maybe the discounts are, you know, the 40 cents up to 70, 80 cents on the dollar. And so pricing has really escalated over the course of time because fair market values have increased across the country. So the price of the note is really tied to how much equity coverage is in that property. So the more equity coverage, the better the underlying collateral, which is the home, the higher the price tag for that mortgage opportunity.
Gotcha. So that's kind of surprising to me that the underlying pricing of the debt on the property would still be tied to the old adage of, you know, real estate location, location, location. You know, your rural farmland, your stuff out in the sticks is going to be, you know, priced a certain way, but, you know, a house in Georgetown or the middle of St. Petersburg, Florida, or, you know, Sarasota is going to be priced significantly different. You know, obviously according to the metrics of seniority or, you know, it being junior. Now, what exactly, if, you know, for those terms, I think it's easy for people to wrap their head around, okay, a senior mortgage is something that our season one has been something that someone's been paying on for 20 years, but is there kind of a line of demarcation when it comes to looking at that? So that way people know kind of in general, if they're, let's just say, looking at a tape of mortgages of saying, okay, you know, here's what these are, here's what, you know, I can maybe negotiate on price, you know, what kind of line is drawn? Is it like 5 years? Is it 10 years mm-hmm. paying on it? You know, what does that look like?
Sure. So if you're asking about, I'll first take it from the distress mortgage standpoint. So the distress mortgage standpoint, note investors go into the purchase assuming that they're going to take back the property. So that is, you know, the assumption homeowner hasn't paid in 4 or 5 years. You know, what's the likelihood of them paying? So it's probably a greater likelihood you're going to take back the property. So what's the property worth and what's the location and so forth. And so that's why there's heavier emphasis on the property. Now, also the rule of thumb is the higher the fair market value, the greater likelihood you'll be able to recapture fair market value pricing when you go to resell that property or to create some turnkey rental or some type of exit resolution. The lower the fair market value, the greater the likelihood it's going to lose value through the foreclosure process. So if you have maybe a row house in a blighted area of Cleveland, property's worth 50K. There's nothing for me to think otherwise that I'll get 10K back when I take back the property from it, because it'll be stripped out. It'll be, you know, windows busted and and there'll be squatters in the home and so forth, but you're not going to get that maybe in a 500K home in a suburban community. So now on the performing side, you want to look at longevity of seasoning. There's heavier emphasis on who the homeowner is, and you're really running due diligence more like an originating lender would look at things, who the borrower is, what their profile is, and what their ability to pay. Now, our model is a little bit of a hybrid model. So we actually only focus on pools of mortgages where we have a high level of confidence that the borrower has an ability to pay us. So it's like starting with the end in mind. That's what we do. We actually, a lot of people in our industry, they're focused on the collateral. What's the collateral? What's the collateral? For us, though, we'll place equal emphasis on who the homeowner is and their ability to pay prior to purchasing the mortgage note.
Gotcha. And a quick question on that. Also, I would assume with the riskier side of things, you also run into the higher expense ratio of actually going through and trying to foreclose that. I mean, you're going to have other things like maybe municipal liens, tax liens or something that are cleared before you go to foreclosure and things like that. But there's a potential for other issues besides just the condition of the property to be standing in your way of saying, hey, you know, just because, you know, we've cleared a foreclosure and let's say laid out $5,000-$10,000 to, you know, go through the foreclosure process, mm-hmm. we might have all these other things that have to be cleared. You know, maybe there's a mechanics lien or something, any other of these things that can be, attached to the property that would also have to be cleared up as well to that point. Is that also something to factor in with looking at those?
Yeah. So, if you're buying, we pull owners and encumbrances report on, so O&E reports on every note that we buy before, and we scrub through the data. And so we understand our lien position. We understand any encumbrances, tax liens, and, and so forth, how many liens in general on the property, plus ownership. And, other kinds of data points. Plus, you get a glimpse on the collateral file as well from what the perspective of what is recorded at the county office. So we'll look at that. We'll look at credit reports. So we'll do credit report risk analysis, do bankruptcy searches, because, again, that goes, into the homeowner and their ability to pay, skip tracing. Things that the originating lender will do, we will run that level of scrutiny on each and every mortgage note. But sometimes you have to buy these pools and tranches that can't be broken apart. So what that says is you have to create pricing models with pricing matrices. So if there is defects or some negative points against that mortgage note, you're going to still buy it, but you're going to buy it at a much lower price point to account for the risk that's involved.
Yeah, it's just like, and it kind of goes back to, anything when you're buying it, condition of the actual asset, in this case, it being the mortgage loan, but, you're going to be paying a significantly, deeper discount on a property that has, a sinkhole and it needs a new roof and needs a foundation pinned than you are, one that's, got everything going for it. So I think that's kind of a good point to illustrate to people is that just like with any thing related to real estate, it's condition of the asset. In this case, we're talking about paper, not just whether or not it has burned edges and coffee stains, but actually, what goes into that actual thing, like, encumbrances, the ability to repay, condition and things like that. And also the fact that, these types of assets are sold, like you said, in tranche, it's for the most part. And, here at Advanta, I've dealt with plenty of clients that have just bought kind of a point of sale thing. Someone might have 10 mortgages and say, hey, I want to free up capital to do something else. Here's this mortgage I'll sell to you. Or maybe they have a few distressed ones they've bought individually. But for the most part, these types of debt are sold kind of on tape. You're not just picking out one. You'll get a bank saying, hey, here's what we're offloading this month. There's 30 of them. Take a look. Do you want it or not? You can't really say, oh, well, kind of go cafeteria style saying, oh, these look great, but yeah, you can keep the other ones that don't look so hot.
Yeah. I mean, we've purchased, we own and manage about $75 million worth of mortgages currently. And so, we've been at this for a while. And I could just tell you that, you know, there are some other factors outside due diligence. Obviously, you should know what you're buying before you buy it, right? That's a good rule of thumb. But post-purchase, there are some secret sauce that you can throw into the mix that will help you be profitable over the long haul as a note investor, as a, you know, as an income fund that we run and so forth, whatever level you play at. And that is, I can tell you that one of the things that we've done that has led us to a lot of success with our collectability rate. So that's the rate at which, you know, homeowners are paying, the percentage of the overall portfolio that's paying as they should be. We're at 96.5%. We've been maintaining that for a long while. And it's because we do modifications with homeowners based on their current financial situation. So we're not gonna you know, try to squeeze blood from a rock. We're gonna work with them where they're at currently financially, and we can make concessions because we bought it at a discount.
Sure.
The second thing is that we treat all the homeowners with a great deal of compassion and humility and transparency. So when we work with a homeowner, we're building a relationship. We're treating them as a customer because they are going to be a paying customer in the end. And so we give them three options to all the homeowners that we work with. So, you know, kind of like a best, better, good, you know, options. And the more they put down, the lower their monthly payments, and we make other concessions and so forth. So people appreciate that. And we hear all the time that no lender has treated them, you know, in such a kind way. You know, at the end, we're a business and, you know, money is owed, but that's not to say you can't do it in a very humane way.
No, absolutely. And that's one of the things that always kind of, you know, bugged me getting into, you know, the space that I, and by extension you work in, of just seeing, you know, I kind of started my career back in, you know, the end of 2011, 2012, when we were trying to, or I should say a lot of our clients were trying to buy all these REO properties. They were trying to get some of this, you know, these foreclosed debts off the books of these banks, and just, you know, just seeing kind of some of the huge issues that people had run into, and just, you know, the very callous nature of that business of, you know, they, you know, granted these companies were taking in, had huge amounts of bad debt on their books, so they can't offer a human touch to a lot of people, but they didn't really offer a human touch to anyone per se. You know, I won't get into my feelings about certain large financial institutions on that, but, you know, catch me off of a podcast and I will give you those.
Well, but, Alex, yeah. Funny, like, you know, we're talking about poor customer service within the financial institution arena. How about poor customer service across the board in every industry? I mean, it's almost getting more pronounced.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that you say that. And then they literally have legislation coming out like Dodd-Frank that aims to, you know, ameliorate some of that with, you know, disclosures and knowledge and things like that, that, you know, borrowers have. And that would kind of lead me into my next question. I know I segued a little bit, but, you know, when it comes to, and I know professionally people that are, you know, mortgage loan originators, they, you know, underwrite Fannie Freddie, jumbo, you know, FHA, VA, all the USDA loans all day long. That's what they work for. And just the amount of red tape that they have to go through on the new origination side, I know, is very cumbersome. Now, when it comes to the modification side of it, buying existing debt, you know, it's easy to say, hey, you know, I go and work with a borrower to try to get some stuff modified. What kind of legal overhead or like, you know, that kind of overhead do you have to go to a borrower and say, hey, this has already been originated, let's find something that works? Do you have to kind of go through the whole other income verification, all that kind of stuff to be able to get these people in a better situation? Is it a lot lax? Is it more? What kind of situation do you have to work in when it comes to buying underperforming debt to try to get it reperforming or get it to be, you know, something that is a, you know, investment grade vehicle for you?
Yeah, so it's less intense than on the origination side. There are, you know, we're modifying the terms of the original note. So we're not originating a new mortgage, a new note. And so, but with that said, you know, we still have to be in compliance within each state. You know, some states you need debt collector's license, other states you need servicing licensing. We work with a licensed servicer, you know, that helps kind of mitigate some of the regulatory risks. We have an attorney that just works on regulation for us. So there is a heavy, heavy cost, legal cost. To be in this industry, I would say that's probably the number one risk and the highest barrier to entry into note investing. And it wasn't like that 10 years when I started. And I've written about it in my first book, Note Investing Made Easier. It's increased, it's squeezed out. On one side, it's unfortunate because it has squeezed out a lot of mom and pop retail note investors that actually came in for the same reason I'm here. And that's to help homeowners stay in their homes while making cash flow. And so that's really the right way to do. We're cleaning up, you know, bad loans that were originated in the 08 crisis. And that's legacy paper. And we're cleaning that up. But regulation can really affect a lot of people. And we always suspect that the larger lenders have a hand in a lot of the regulation that's out there.
So yeah. It's intentional. With anything, you know, you see, you know, the people that aren't complaining are probably the people that lobbied for it. You know, all these people saying, oh, X, Y, and Z, it's like, but you don't really see, you know, Wells Fargo or these people going out and saying this legislation is crushing us. You know, they're the ones that are like, oh, it's so bad. And of course, they're complaining, which is kind of funny. But to another point, which also I want to make sure people are clear, you know, the regulations between dealing with owner occupants and investment properties that are non-owner occupied are vastly different. You know, the legal overhead is significantly different. Primarily, you are looking at owner occupied properties, correct?
Correct. Because, and that's how we mitigate risk here. You know, we want to help homeowners stay in their homes. We can't do that if homeowners aren't in their homes, if they're tenants. And landlords tend to leave their properties distressed more than owner occupied properties. So, you know, our whole model is on working on homeowners as a primary residence.
Yeah. And also, you know, the drive and the motivation for someone to want to, you know, not have a foreclosure is significantly better when it's your roof over your head, as opposed to your portfolio where you go, you know what, we're just going to let them take these back. I can handle, you know, the foreclosure and the knock to my credit. You know, this is an investment, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still going to bed in a warm, or in Florida, an air conditioned house, you know, to try to do that. So do you strictly, at least from your metric, you know, would it be fair to say that the risk for the note investor of buying owner occupied paper versus investor owned paper is higher for the investor side stuff?
Yeah. So, I think it depends on what level you're playing, how far upstream you are. And so, when you get to a certain mid-level range or become a big boy, you know, you already have all the legal and compliance team in place. So you're going to avoid all the risks at, you know, every turn. You're going to account for the risk and avoid them. And, but when you're a mom and pop, it doesn't matter, if it's owner occupied or tenant occupied. There's heavy regulatory risk. And, you know, you can have a homeowner that calls, you know, attorney general just on a phone call. And that could, you know, even though you may have done nothing wrong. So this is why, it's just best to treat people right. And every, we kind of look at it like every action we do or every correspondence we have with the homeowner, it needs to be in a way where we're proposing something that benefits them. So as long as we kind of keep that in mind, that if we talk to someone, well, you know, can we understand where you're at financially so we can work out options that give you empowerment and help you get this back on track? Like, that's our conversation, not a call just to, you know, tell you how bad you've been or something like that.
Yeah. And I think that works, you know, to any of the, you know, it goes back to the, oh, what's the term I'm looking for? It's a very, you know, Andrew Carnegie, you know, it's like, you know, you kind of get out what you put in. You know, if you treat people with respect, you're going to get it back. If you go in with, you know, fire and brimstone, say, hey, you're a bum borrower, you know, here's what you owe us, here's what we're willing to do, you know, your likelihood of recapturing that is very low. So I think that's kind of a good point to say, is that, you know, just because you're looking at something that is distressed, you know, don't take it as kind of a slight saying, oh, you know, anything bad about particularly the people on the other end of these these notes, you know, there's a human factor to this. And if you play on that human factor, you can probably have more success than if you just, you know, are going kind of that sterile surgical, you know, slice and dice, and what we get at the end of it is what we get. You know, is at least kind of, you know, the general focus of what I'm getting from you on your investment strategy with this.
It's like a two-pronged approach. You know, one, you need to have a regulation plan to mitigate and be in compliance as a note investor. And then number two, you need to treat people humanely, so you don't prompt any action against you that's adverse. And so if you kind of do those things, now where a lot of mom and pops really struggle is they come in and they don't understand the depth of compliance. So they might buy a note here, might buy a note there. Oh, well, that note is just in Pennsylvania. No, what's the big deal? Or North Carolina, you know, and they don't understand that they need to be registered in those states. They need to have, you know, in some states you can't even have direct contact with the homeowner. And you just need to know all the ins and outs. Otherwise, you will ignorance will get you caught up very badly.
Well, and also just for the fact that, you know, not only of just the, you know, the contact side of it, you know, when worst comes to worst, the way you do foreclosures, there's 50 different flavors in the United States. You know, you have judicial states, you have states that run things completely different. I know for the
non-judicial. Judicial and non-judicial.
And I know at least, you know, there's a huge difference between, you know, debt in Florida and versus debt in the state of Georgia, which is, you know, the two places that we operate the most, and we operate nationwide. But, you know, seeing that, and then also types of properties as well can even differ from that. You know, some states, especially when it comes to, you know, investing in, let's say, notes with mobile homes, depending on if they're tied to the land or not, you know, you have things where, you know, some things are done on more of a retail side, like a car. You know, it's, there's so many different things to look at that I think, and one thing I really try to harp on with anyone listening to this, or at least my professional side with doing IRAs and investments, is really and truly understanding what you're doing, and also talking to people that are experts in this stuff. You know, talking to people like you that, you know, do this professionally, you know, if you want to take your first stab at it, you know, there's a lot of things to understand when it comes to doing debt note investing. You know, buying a house is, I think, is significantly easier than buying paper.
100%. And I get asked this often, you know, if I have 50K, how should I start? How should I start in the industry? And my response has always been, this is through hard lessons learned, by the way, is you should go to as many conferences, industry conferences as you can. You should read as many books as you can. You should be connecting in community groups that are focused on mortgage note investing. And your money is best spent in education before you even think remotely about pulling the trigger.
Yeah, buy a lot of cups of coffee for people. before you buy some notes. So yeah, there's definitely that legal overhead, which is huge to it, past just looking at what you can potentially do with that. Now, let's transition a little bit into, you know, you mentioned that you have a bit of, you know, a multi-pronged approach to this of saying, hey, you know, how do we look at this? Now, when it comes to, let's say you've negotiated with a bank, you have a tape of mortgages that you picked up, you know, granted, they're going to be on a scale. It's going to be a spectrum of, you know, hey, this stuff is really awesome, and this stuff is maybe not the best. Now, do you just try to wholesale some of the bad stuff out, or do you kind of only look at stuff where you're taking in stuff that realistically you can work within your business model to get everything to the point you wanted to? Some is going to cost you more, some is going to cost you less. But, you know, when it comes to that, what do you look at that? You know, again, is it a scale? Do you just try to wholesale some out? Do you only take stuff in that you know you can work with? Tell us a little bit about how y'all operate there.
Yeah. So, you know, I learned many years ago that, you can have your Super Bowl projections on who's going to go to the Super Bowl and, you know, who's going to be dominant. And then you're going to say, you know, who's going to be horrific. And I'm a Jets fan, so usually I'm horrific.
I'm sorry to hear that.
But yeah, I know, right? But it gets funny over time. But anyway, so what I've learned though is that the ones that you think are dogs could be your most profitable ones, because those are the ones you're going to price less based on defects. And some of those, you know, you could have a homeowner that needs to sell their house because they just need to sell their house, and they're going to cash you out in full at par. And, you know, and then you could have the ones that are home runs, but, you know, they want to litigate with you and they want to drag you out because they live in a $1 million home, but guess what? Newsflash, they can't afford it. and so you just get all these different strokes. So we don't wholesale anything out. What we do is we run, statute of limitation tests to understand, you know, what we can't collect on and what was secured and now is deemed unsecured by the state that the loan was originated in. And we look at other factors that require us to kick those loans out of the purchase opportunity.
Gotcha. Now, when it comes to buying things, and again, this, the way that you buy things is a little bit different than kind of, again, the point of sale things that I mentioned that I've seen a lot of my clients do. But when you get this stuff in, you know, there's certain reports that you can have. I can't remember the name of it, but, you know, kind of encumbrance reports and things like that. Mm-hmm. You can't really start doing the really hands-on, like, you know, talking to the borrower stuff until you actually take possession of that paper. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. You don't have, they don't have a legal obligation to engage with you, and you're not to contact anyone prior to purchase. I mean, that would be like prior to purchasing a house, and then you go and, you know, try to talk to the tenant who's occupying the property. You're just not allowed to do that.
Gotcha. So let's say you've taken in this block, this tranche of loans. You know, what's kind of your first step? Is there kind of a standardized way that you go about saying, okay, great. You know, we have our script, let's go out and talk to these people. And again, I know it changes from state to state, you know, what you're allowed to say, who you have to go through. But let's say, you know, you're dealing in a state where you can directly contact these people as, you know, a general rule. Cause I'm assuming that the way you talk to people like this would probably be something that you would put it similarly into a letter that has to come from a debt collector or an attorney. I'm assuming that all these things are probably kind of themed the same, correct?
Yeah, we'll send out a welcome package. You know, in some cases, we'll send it out through our attorney, and so it'll just like welcome them to our company. I have the RESPA documents, you know, the hello letter, and it'll just let them know that we're very interested in working with them, understanding where they are now, just engaging in dialogue. We don't try to make the first correspondence like the hammer. You know, we're not trying to be, you know, come at people and say, well, you know, pay up now, you owe this much, blah, blah, blah. We want to have a conversation with them to see where they're at. Because at the end of the day, if you work an arrangement that's not sustainable with where they are today, then it's going to fall through. So it's just in everyone's best interest to start with forming the relationship.
Yeah. So once you form that relationship, what would you say is kind of the most common route forward? You know, I think you mentioned, you know, there's loan modifications, there's, you know, maybe mm-hmm. adjustment to loan term and period, or there's cash, you know, deed in lieu, things like mm-hmm. that. What would you say is maybe kind of the percentage points on each one of those options that people take? Are most people saying, you know what, great, let's try to modify this. Let's try to get, you know, something adjusted where we can stay here and maybe adjust, you know, the loan term or the payment rate. Yeah. What is kind of the most common outcome? And then what are the percentages of the others?
Yeah, so it's about, we're running at about an 85% loan modification rate. So we're most people by far want to work out a term. They want to stay in their homes. They realize if they rented the apartment down the street, rental rates have gone up dramatically across the country. So it's probably a cheaper option financially to stay in their home. Plus, there just probably is emotional equity. You know, they're raising their family there. So we find that another 10% will refinance and pay us off, or they'll sell the property, pay us off, and then some miscellaneous activity, bankruptcy filings, and as well as foreclosure. Now, we've been running at about a 1% foreclosure rate on our portfolio of delinquent mortgages, which is insane if you think about it. You know, average you know, average aged mortgage is about 4 years we have. So, I mean, we have a phenomenal track record of connecting with homeowners and working out some options, some exit that works for them. And so we have to avoid foreclosure. Now, when I first started buying mortgages 10 years ago, equity coverage wasn't there. More the bankruptcy filings were up and my systems weren't in place. I mean, we were foreclosing about 10% of the time.
Okay. So what does it look like typically with a loan modification? You know, there's all sorts of things you can modify: interest rate, you can modify term, you know, payment schedule. You know, what exactly does it look like typically for a loan modification? Are they always very, very unique to the actual borrower, or are there kind of some general, you know, uniform tenets that actually occur over that spectrum when it comes to modifying a mortgage?
Yeah, so we have one practice that we believe in that is always the case 100% of the time, and that is we do fixed rate loan modifications. So it is very important to us that we allow the homeowner the ability to own their home at some point in their life. And so we do not believe in adjustable rate mortgages. I think there's a moral issue with them. And because a lot, I'll just say, you know, get on the soapbox, you know, due diligence is performed when the rate is fixed for the first year or two. It's not performed on what's going to happen when it adjusts out. And by then that lender has sold the paper, you know, a few times over. And so we do everything with fixed rate and allow the homeowner to pay principal as well as interest on the monthly payments.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. My, you know, personal opinion is that adjustable rates really should be only for investors. You know, that there's a very good reason that, you know, an adjustable rate can be very beneficial for an investor. You know, allows the, you know, investor buying the property to have more headroom to do the improvements, turn it around, refi. Or and it also gives the, and you know, the person making the investment on the paper side, you know, an incentive to say, hey, you know, I'm collecting less, but then, you know, the longer term down the road, my capital is going to make more money. Mm-hmm. Which I really, you know, disagree with on a lot of levels when it comes to owner occupied stuff. And again, that's kind of what has got us into the whole debacle back in 6, 7, 8 of, you know, well, I mean, one, you know, there was a lot of ninja loans out there. But yeah. Besides that, you know, you just had people, which I think, you know, Dodd-Frank and a lot of things helped to address is that, you know, you had people saying, hey, you want to buy this home? Hey, here's your monthly payment. And they just didn't realize or didn't read or weren't disclosed. You know, there is, you know, some stuff on the, you know, the buyer side, you know, hey, you need to read this 30-page document, but who really does? So that's good to know that you strictly look towards just the, you know, fixed rate thing so they can have P&I, you know, on their loan so they can chip away at that and increase their basis, the value.
What I'll say to that too, is that we eat our own cooking. So that is, we have a collection business, right? We buy these mortgages non-performing. We get them to perform. And then we season them. We ensure that the homeowner's making payments over 12 months, over 24 months, and the homeowner's back on track. Remember, this is mostly a paper. These are good individuals that qualified for a Wells Fargo mortgage some time ago. They just lost their job or got a divorce. Something happened. So it's not as if they've been ducking and dodging creditors all their life. And so once they're back on track, once they're showing that, then they're a candidate to be sold into our income fund that only holds these re-performing mortgages. We buy them into the income fund at an 11, 12% yield, and we pay out our investors at an 8 or 9% annual preferred return, making our payments monthly. So we hold on to the mortgages we modify. And that says a lot because it's in our best interest to do the best, you know, put our best foot forward with the relationship.
Yeah. And that's really kind of interesting. And I wanted to try to, you know, get into that because, you know, there's so much to do with the paper side of things, but on your investment strategy side, so you have, you know, explain that a little bit. So you do have an acquisition arm that buys these, gets them performing, and then you have the fund. Is there investment opportunity for people on both sides of that? Or is it strictly just you deploying the capital, getting the assets, so then in turn sell into the fund?
Yeah. So the acquisition arm, the collection arm is a separate company, and that's privately owned by my partner Sean and myself. And so there's no investors on that. And so now on the income fund, we launched the income fund BeQuest as an evergreen fund about 3 years ago. And my partner and I, we did it for our family, just friends and family. And we launched it as a $50 million fund. And we wanted something that we could pass down to our children. So it wasn't meant to be known, if you will. It's a private fund. And so we started through the books. I've written 4 books, three of which are on mortgage note investing, one's on cash flow investing. And so through that, through people kind of connecting with me, I learned to find that, hey, brilliant, the revelation here, there's other people that want monthly passive income. And so we started bringing in people outside, friends and family, in 2021-ish. And now we have about 28 million in there under management. And we have about 120 investors, and we have opened up a second fund and so forth. So those funds are open to investors. And really our target is to provide monthly passive income that's consistent and predictable in a world that's crazy.
No, understandable. So how is that is it a Reg D or Reg A? How is that offered?
Yeah, 506C Reg D income fund. So it's set up for accredited investors. And
And what kind of so what's the tax treatment of the disbursements from that? Is it all interest income on K-1, or how's that paid out?
Yeah, so they receive a K-1 because they're an equity stakeholder. And on that K-1, there's two forms of income received into the fund. One is interest income, like you mentioned. So that's taxed at ordinary income levels. And then there's also realized gains. So when we receive payoffs on accounts, so that portion of income is called out as capital gains. So every year, the investor is going to get back a K-1, and it's going to have a breakout between interest income and capital gains. And it's normally about a 75-25 split, with 75% being interest income.
Okay, cool. And is this a limited partner interest, LLC?
Yes. Yes. So, yep, you're an equity stakeholder in the company. Your portion of ownership is based on your investment against the cumulative investment for that class.
Cool. And, I always like to highlight people on here, but if business people can get out as ordinary income, using an IRA is always a good idea, help shield yourself from some of that. And, we have a lot of IRA clients that like to invest in debt. And there really aren't a whole lot of people out there kind of doing what you're doing on the non-performing side, at least that I have seen. So again, I always like to highlight, what people have going on, but wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't kind of, season it in there with saying, inherently, the tax benefits of being able to do that stuff through an IRA, with how that stuff is paid out, but also the ease of passive income with things like this, I think is very attractive to people, whether you're doing it through a fund like BeQuest or, just kind of doing it point of sale. The nice thing about doing debt investing is you don't have to deal with tenants and toilets. Once you kind of do that front end amount of work, nothing really changes. I mean, hopefully nothing does. It's that, I hate the term, but it works, mailbox money. I don't know why that's like nails on a chalkboard to me, but maybe just because it's always the infomercials.
It's overused, yeah. Alex.
It's the infomercial people with people that have never invested a cent in their life saying mailbox money. But yeah, it's it really kind of illustrates, the benefit to a lot of people, because let's face it, people are busy, and being able to invest in something that's not going to take up, your whole life. And is easy enough to understand. With anything, there's complexities to this, like I think you mentioned, or that we certainly have gone through, of how this stuff works with, dealing with different legalities of different places, how to make sure that you can do these modifications correctly and in compliance. It's certainly a big deal, but once you kind of get over those hurdles, things clear up a lot. It's not a whole you know, other thing on the other side of that mountain. It's, you know, a pretty nice slope to ski down, if you will.
Yeah, there's, you know, in our whole discussion here, I just want to kind of just put something out there. When someone's looking at whoever's listening, an investment opportunity in general, you should be looking at three risk factors. One is the operator risk factor, who the operator is, their level of expertise. Also, how much money they have in the opportunity that they're trying to pitch you at. And then second, capital preservation. How are you acquiring these mortgages? How are you acquiring these assets? Performing due diligence? How are you working them out through asset management so that you're going to protect my capital? And then what the rate of return risk is it enough to, you know, achieve my financial objectives? And I think these are very important things to ask. When we launched the fund, I mean, I'm the largest investor in the fund. I have $1 million cash in there. And so my partner has 700-800. So we put our own money in up front. I think that should be the first question any investor asks an operator with any investment opportunity. How much money does that person physically have in there?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I've gone through that, I've had a few podcasts specifically on, you know, looking at, you know, syndications is a very broad term, but private investment vehicles, granted, mostly they focus on commercial real estate, things like that. But, you know, you can kind of lump that in there with an investment provider in that space of what you do. And especially echoing that, one of the very common threads that I've talked with, you know, countless people on, and I wholeheartedly agree with that, is, you know, look at the operators, look at, you know, the expected rate of returns, what they're disclosing to you. You know, are these people investing themselves? What is their track record? Mm-hmm. And it's these very basic things that anyone would think is, you know, oh, well, of course I want to know, you know, if these people have experience doing this. But you would be surprised at how many, granted, maybe not, you know, the surprising fact that so many people haven't, but just that it can be that simple to get a very good foundation with that. Granted, there is a lot of other stuff that goes into it. Doing due diligence is a very important part of this. But understanding some of the biggest things that you can do to protect yourself are some of the most basic. And just so far as understanding all of those, and also one thing I would add to that is that, you know, when it comes to doing this stuff, if you are talking to someone that's providing an investment and they are uncomfortable or not willing or giving you a dodgy answer to any one of those questions, it's your money. Walk away. You know, people ask, you know, I enjoy it when people ask me at Advanta saying, hey, you know, what happens if Advanta goes out of business? I'm happy to answer that question. It's easy enough. You know, granted, I would sincerely hope we don't, and we have a very good track record and a good growth record, and we enjoy being very good stewards of our clients' capital, and it's shown over the past 20 years we've been in business. But if you ask someone the hard question and they're not willing to answer it, you know, that should also go into your decision factor on investing into any type of industry.
Absolutely. I mean, all these are great points. You know, it's interesting. I know FTX makes headlines with Sam Bankman-Fried, Bernie Madoff, like all, but to a lot of people, they seem like Hollywood actors. They seem distant. Like, oh, well, I never would have invested in FTX anyway. Well, there's a lot of, I talk to investors daily. I raise capital here at the company, and there's not a week that goes by where I haven't talked to someone who lost $500,000 in the stock market with their wealth manager last year. And it's just like unreal what people, and then, you know, these individuals at these firms, they're not answering phone calls. They're not, you know, letting people redeem. They're, you know, all it's bizarre. So it's not even like FTX is maybe seems so far off, but there's just a lot of, you know, things that shouldn't be happening to many people now.
Yeah. And to that point as well, like, you know, it illustrates the benefit of investing in these class of assets, of things that, granted, it's paper, but it's, you know, it's a secure, you know, it's secured with tangible assets. You know, it's backed by real estate. If things go down, you know, you have that option of foreclosure to take in a tangible asset. It's not a kind of the more ethereal paper asset where, hey, I have a stock certificate, the company goes to zero and now it's kindling. You know, there's other recourse to that. And to your point too, the Blackstone Real Estate Fund, the largest REIT in the United States, mm-hmm. froze withdrawals a few weeks ago. largest REIT in the United States, has been buying everything, froze client withdrawals. So, to the point of the benefit of alternative investing, and it's the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast, I'd like to illustrate the advantages of that, of having real, tangible, securely backed assets is hugely beneficial, not only on the times of, it's easy to see its benefit on the 45 degree uptick that we've seen over the past, since March of 2020, or in the broader sense, without that blip of COVID, really since, 2013, 2014, of almost everything appreciating at an unheard of rate. It's a really good hedge, in times when things, turn down, having things that cash flow, value can be irrelevant if you have steady cash flow. If you have something that's paying you out a fixed rate of return, the underlying asset can go half of its value. But if your cash flow remains the same, then it's, kind of value agnostic investing, which is a thing that a lot of our clients at Advanta really enjoy. And by virtue of, mortgage note investing is also a good benefit.
Yeah. And I think so much of what you just said, which was a lot, and a lot of valuable information. It comes down to accessibility to Advanta or like BeQuest or us. Like, you can call. My partner is, has his IRA with you guys. I've talked to Scott. I've talked to many people on your team over the course of time, and it's just you guys are always accessible. And so I that's like half the battle. I mean, can you call the CEO of BlackRock now and be like, hey, why can't I get my quarterly distributions? You're not going to get through to anywhere near his level. And, but you want some accessibility so you can get these questions answered.
Yeah, absolutely. Information is king. And again, kind of going back to what we talked about at the beginning of the due diligence and the research being really what you need to look at, which is, one of the core tenets that BeQuest does, of saying, hey, let's go out there and look at the quality of this investment, and being able to access that information and understanding, and then being able to talk to the people that are doing this to get a pulse on, hey, why are these decisions made? And that goes back to, someone like us being good stewards of our clients' assets and you being good stewards of the client's capital. As well. So with that said, I think we're hitting right up on an hour. It's been great conversing with you today, Martin. If people want to get in touch with you, they want to learn more about either the investing side with your company or just anything else, how can they reach out to y'all?
Yeah. So you can email me at martin@bqfunds.com and martin@bqfunds.com. If you do reach out, I have a living financial statement that I've been using for many years, my wife and I, and breaks out passive income, active income. I'll be happy to share it. So if you do reach out with any questions, I'll shoot that back to you. It's a great tool, and I believe in doing that.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Barton. Again, my name's Alex Perney. This has been the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at advantaira.com and subscribe.